From Pacifica Radio, this is Democracy Now!
Your government failed you. Those entrusted with protecting you failed you. And I failed you. We tried hard, but that doesn't matter because we failed. And for that failure, I would ask, once all the facts are out, for your understanding and for your forgiveness.
Former counterterrorism chief Richard Clark testifies. We'll hear excerpts of yesterday's 9/11 hearing where Clark slams Bush and the White House over 9/11 and Iraq. But first, she may not be publicly testifying before the 9/11 Commission, but she is busy at work. Today, in a Democracy Now! Exclusive, we look at the role Condoleezza Rice is playing in pressuring Jamaica to expel Haitian President Jean-Bertrand Aristide. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. President Bush's former terrorism czar, Richard Clark, blasted the Bush administration Wednesday during the 9/11 hearings for not considering terrorism to be an urgent issue before the September 11th attacks. Clark also accused Bush of undermining the war on terror by invading Iraq. Clark began his testimony apologizing to the American public and the families of 9/11 victims.
Your government failed you. Those entrusted with protecting you failed you. And I failed you.
The White House led the attack on Richard Clark, and it continued yesterday with help from Fox News. The network released a transcript to a background briefing Clark gave in August 2002, praising the administration's fight against terrorism. Clark defended his actions Wednesday, saying it was part of his job.
I was asked to highlight the positive aspects of what the administration had done and to minimize the negative aspects of what the administration had done.
Clark's testimony came near the end of 2 days of public hearings held by the Independent 9/11 Commission. Despite repeated requests from commissioners, National Security Advisor Condoleezza Rice would not publicly testify. While Clark's testimony provided the fireworks of the 2 days of hearings, the New York Times reports the four staff reports given by the commissioners offered sweeping new details about how both the Clinton and Bush administrations fumbled in preventing 9/11. The Times reports the commissioners highlighted, quote, story of bureaucratic miscommunication, diplomatic dead ends, military hesitation, intelligence failures, political rivalries, and policy miscalculations at the highest levels of two presidential administrations. It also emerged Wednesday Richard Clark was not alone in feeling frustrated by the Bush administration's handling of the terror threat. The 9/11 Commission revealed two veteran CIA counterterrorism experts who dealt with bin Laden considered resigning during the summer of 2001 in order to take public their fears about an imminent attack against the United States. And the director of Central Intelligence, George Tenet's own deputy, John McLaughlin, told the commission in an earlier interview he was worried that not enough was being done during the summer of 2001 by the new Bush administration. The Chicago Tribune points out these concerns actually mirror what President Bush himself told Washington Post journalist Bob Woodward. In his book, Bush at War, Woodward wrote that the president, quote, acknowledged bin Laden was not his focus or that of his national security team before September 11th. Woodward quotes Bush directly saying, quote, I didn't feel that sense of urgency and my blood was not nearly as boiling. In Colorado, the 19-year-old woman who's accused basketball star Kobe Bryant of rape was forced to undergo 3.5 hours of questioning about her medical and sexual history by Bryant's lawyers Wednesday. Bryant was also in the courtroom, marking the first time he and the woman were in the same room since their encounter last summer in a Colorado hotel. Wednesday's pretrial proceeding was held in order for the judge to determine how much of the woman's private life can be presented to the jury when the case goes to trial. Women's advocates around the country said the move to force the woman to testify could discourage other women from reporting sexual assaults. Advocate Jerry Elster of Los Angeles said, quote, "I'm frightened about this decision only for the fact that families will not support victims and survivors to go report because they can now say, look what happened to so-and-so. It feels like a huge setback for survivors and victims to come." A 1992 study by the National Crime Victims Research and Treatment Center at the Medical University of South Carolina found 84% of sexual assault victims do not go to the police. 14 states asked the Bush administration Wednesday for permission to use alternative methods for showing academic gains under the No Child Left Behind law, this according to the New York Times. In a letter to Education Secretary Rod Paige, the 14 chief state school officers wrote that, quote, "Without any changes to the law, calculations suggest that within a few years, the vast majority of all schools will be identified as in need of improvement. Many of those schools will be given that designation despite having shown steady and significant improvement for all groups of students." Campaign records show that executives at media giant Clear Channel have given 24 times more money to President Bush's campaign than to Senator John Kerry's. To date, Clear Channel executives have given Bush about $42,000 in personal contributions and just under $1,800 to Kerry. In addition, Clear Channel's Political Action Committee has given more than three-quarters of its federal contributions to Republicans. Clear Channel's political leanings re-entered the headlines after it pulled Howard Stern's show from its network. Publicly, Clear Channel said the show pulled Stern because of indecency, but Stern charged the real reason was that he had started criticizing President Bush on the air. A year ago this week, Private Jessica Lynch came under fire after her convoy crashed in Iraq. 11 soldiers died. On Tuesday, at a ceremony to mark the anniversary, the widow of one of the soldiers who died in the incident blasted President Bush for, quote, "lying to America to justify the Iraq invasion." A county in Oregon has stopped giving out all marriage licenses until the state decides who can and cannot wed. The commissioner of Benton County told Reuters, quote, "It may seem odd. We need to treat everyone in our county equally." Meanwhile, the American Civil Liberties Union filed a lawsuit Wednesday against the state of Oregon for failing to register more than 2,500 marriage licenses that have been issued in and around Portland since March 3rd. Multnomah County is now the only jurisdiction in the country that is still issuing same-sex marriage licenses. The United Nations Human Rights Commission condemned Israel Wednesday for assassinating Hamas leader Sheikh Ahmed Yassin. The vote was 31-2. The United States and Australia voted against the measure, which Israeli officials described as, quote, "Israel bashing at its worst." 18 countries abstained. Meanwhile, near the West Bank city of Nablus, Israeli soldiers stopped a 14-year-old Wednesday wearing a vest of explosives. Soldiers then persuaded the boy to help them dismantle the bomb. After the explosives were detonated, the Israeli army paraded the boy in front of the media. Images of the incident were broadcast around the world. The New York Times took the unusual step of dedicating a third of its front page to publishing five color photos of the incident. It marked the second time in about a week a Palestinian child was found trying to transport explosives across a checkpoint. A new study funded by the British Ministry of Defense has found that babies whose fathers served in the first Gulf War are 50% more likely to have physical abnormalities than those born to soldiers not sent to the region. This according to a report in the London Telegraph. The United States and 11 other countries asked Wednesday for an exemption to an international treaty that restricts the use of a highly toxic ozone-destroying pesticide called methyl bromide. According to the Scripps Howard News Service, the Bush administration says U.S. farmers, particularly California strawberry farmers and Florida tomato growers, need to keep using the pesticide until cost-effective alternatives are found. A spokesperson for the Natural Resources Defense Council said, quote, "This is a very clear-cut case of unmitigated corporate greed." And the AFL-CIO has launched an 8-day Show Us the Jobs tour in an effort to highlight what the union calls the country's biggest job crisis since the Great Depression. According to the AFL-CIO, the country has lost 3 million private sector jobs since Bush took office. The tour ends next Wednesday in Washington, where unemployed workers from each state will lobby legislators on Capitol Hill to enact legislation to stop employers from sending jobs overseas and to encourage job growth in this country. Tubby Freedom Dub here on Democracy Now!, the War and Peace Report. Coming up in a minute, in the last segment of the program, our exclusive on the role Condoleezza Rice is playing in trying to have Haitian President Jean-Bertrand Aristide ousted from the Caribbean. But right now, we'll go to the top story of the day, Richard Clark. I'm Amy Goodman here with Juan Gonzalez.
And welcome to all of our viewers and listeners around the country and around the world on democracynow.org. Amy, the hearings this week, one of the things that's been amazing is the lack of wall-to-wall coverage by the commercial media. No network coverage. Fox, even the Fox cable station, wasn't running the hearings. CNN was, and obviously C-SPAN was. But given the enormous impact of 9/11, one of the bloodiest days in American history, it's amazing how the Lewinsky scandal was considered the meat for regular wall-to-wall coverage and a variety of other scandals around in the past, but not this important and crucial commission hearing.
Yeah, even C-SPAN sometimes went to C-SPAN 3, which most people don't have.
Right. Well, anyway, the commission investigating the September 11th attacks has wrapped up 2 days of hearings in Washington, and with few exceptions, the hearings brought little new to the surface. Largely, the questions were tame and friendly. The biggest buzz of the day surrounding the testimony of former counterterrorism chief Richard Clark. Before Clark testified, the commission heard from CIA Director George Tenet and President Clinton's National Security Advisor Sandy Berger.
Noticeably absent from the hearings was National Security Advisor Condoleezza Rice. Throughout the 2 days of hearings, commissioners publicly reiterated their request Rice testify under oath. She has refused, citing separation of powers, to testify in her place. The White House dispatched Undersecretary of State Richard Armitage. While his testimony produced some interesting discussion about Rice's absence, it was Richard Clark's testimony that made news. His testimony comes amidst a political firestorm over the publication this week of his book, Against All Enemies. The book accuses the White House of ignoring the threat posed by al-Qaeda leading up to 9/11, and that Bush wanted to strike Iraq immediately after the attacks, despite no evidence that Baghdad was involved.
Clark is widely viewed as a leading figure in national security circles. He held top posts under every president since Reagan and served as both President Clinton and President Bush's top anti-terrorism official.
With family members of victims of the World Trade Center attacks sitting behind him, Clark began his testimony.
Your government failed you. Those entrusted with protecting you failed you. And I failed you. We tried hard, but that doesn't matter because we failed. And for that failure, I would ask, once all the facts are out, for your understanding and for your forgiveness. With that, Mr. Chairman, I'll be glad to take your questions.
Hey there. Questioning will be led by Senator Gorton. Are you leading off, or Commissioner Roma?
2 minutes.
Commissioner Roma.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Welcome, Mr. Clark. I want to thank you as I start my questions for your 30 years of public service to the American people. I want to thank you for your sworn testimony before the 9/11 Commission, over 15 hours. And I really want to say, Mr. Clark, that there are a lot of distractions out there today. There are books, a lot of news media, a lot of accusations flying back and forth. I want you to concentrate to the degree you can on the memos, on the email, on the strategy papers, and on the time that we're tasked with looking at on this 9/11 Commission between 1998 and September the 11th. You coordinated counterterrorism policy in both the Clinton and the Bush administrations. I want to know, first of all, was fighting al-Qaeda a top priority for the Clinton administration from 1998 to the year 2001? How high of priority was it in that Clinton administration during that time period?
My impression was that fighting terrorism in general and fighting al-Qaeda in particular were an extraordinarily high priority in the Clinton administration, certainly no higher priority. They were priorities probably of equal importance, such as the Middle East peace process. But I certainly don't know of one that was any higher in the priority of that administration.
With respect to the Bush administration, from the time they took office until September 11th, 2001, you had much to deal with, Russia, China, G8, the Middle East. How high of priority was fighting al-Qaeda in the Bush administration?
I believe the Bush administration in the first 8 months considered terrorism an important issue, but not an urgent issue. President Bush himself says as much in his interview with Bob Woodward in the book Bush at War. He said, "I didn't feel a sense of urgency." George Tenet and I tried very hard to create a sense of urgency by seeing to it that intelligence reports on the al-Qaeda threat were frequently given to the president and other high-level officials. And there was a process underway to address al-Qaeda. But although I continued to say it was an urgent problem, I don't think it was ever treated that way.
Now, you have said in many ways you've issued some blistering attacks on the Bush administration, but you have not held those criticisms from the Clinton administration either. We heard from Mr. Berger earlier that you were critical of the Clinton administration on two areas, not providing aid to the Northern Alliance and not going after the human conveyor belts of jihadists coming out of the sanctuaries in Afghanistan. Are there more in the Clinton administration years? The USS Cole, the response there?
Well, I think, first of all, Mr. Berger is right to say that almost everything I ever asked for in the way of support from him or from President Clinton, I got. We did enormously increase the counterterrorism budget of the federal government, initiated many programs, including what is now called Homeland Security. Mr. Berger is also right to note that I wanted a covert action program to aid Afghan factions to fight the Taliban. And that was not accomplished. He's also right to note that on several occasions, including after the attack on the Cole, I suggested that we bomb all of the Taliban and al-Qaeda infrastructure. Whether or not it would succeed in killing bin Laden, I thought that was the wrong way of looking at the problem. I think the answer is essentially Mr. Berger got it right.
Okay. Let's move into, with my 15 minutes, let's move into the Bush administration. On January the 25th, we've seen a memo that you've written to Dr. Rice urgently asking for a principles review of al-Qaeda. You include helping the Northern Alliance, covert aid, significant new O2 budget authority to help fight al-Qaeda, and response to the USS Cole. You attach to this document both the Linda Plan of 1998 and a strategy paper from December 2000. Do you get a response to this urgent request for a principals meeting on these, and how does this affect your time frame for dealing with these important issues?
I did get a response. The response was that in the Bush administration, I should, and my committee, the Counterterrorism Security Group, should report to the Deputies Committee, which is a sub-cabinet-level committee, and not to the principals, and that, therefore, it was inappropriate for me to be asking for a principals meeting. Instead, there would be a deputies meeting.
So does this slow the process down to go to the deputies rather than to the principals or a small group, as you previously had done?
It slowed it down enormously by months. First of all, the deputies committee didn't meet urgently in January or February. Then when the deputies committee did meet, it took the issue of al-Qaeda as part of a cluster of policy issues, including nuclear proliferation in South Asia, democratization in Pakistan, how to treat the problems, the various problems, including narcotics and other problems in Afghanistan, and launched on a series of deputies' meetings extending over several months to address al-Qaeda in the context of all of those interrelated issues. That process probably ended, I think, in July of 2001. So we were ready for a principals meeting in July, but the principals' calendar was full, and then they went on vacation, many of them, in August, so we couldn't meet in August, and therefore the principals met in September.
So as the Bush administration is carefully considering, from bottom up, a full review of fighting terrorism, what happens to these individual items, like a response to the USS Cole, flying the Predator? Why aren't these decided in a shorter time frame, as they're also going through a larger policy review of how this policy affects Pakistan and other countries? Important considerations, but why can't you do both?
The deputies committee, its chairman, Mr. Hadley, and others, thought that all of these issues were sufficiently interrelated that they should be taken up as a set of issues and pieces of them should not be broken off.
Did you agree with that?
No, I didn't agree with much
of that. Were you frustrated by this process?
I was sufficiently frustrated that I asked to be reassigned.
When was this?
Probably May or June, certainly no later than June. And there was agreement in that time frame, in the May or June time frame, that I would be, my request would be honored, and I would be reassigned on the 1st of October to a new position to deal with cybersecurity, a position that I requested be created.
Are you saying that the frustration got to a high enough level that it wasn't your portfolio, it wasn't doing a lot of things at the same time, it was that you weren't getting fast enough action on what you were requesting?
That's right. My view was that this administration, while it listened to me, didn't either believe me that there was an urgent problem or was unprepared to act as though there were an urgent problem. And I thought, if the administration doesn't believe its national coordinator for counterterrorism when he says there's an urgent problem, and if it's unprepared to act as though there's an urgent problem, then probably I should get another job. I thought cybersecurity was, and I still think cybersecurity is, an extraordinarily important issue for which this country is very underprepared, and I thought perhaps I could make a contribution if I worked full-time on that issue.
You then write a letter or a memo on September the 4th to Dr. Rice expressing some of these frustrations several months later, if you say the time frame is May or June when you decided to resign. A memo comes out that we have seen on September the 4th. You are blunt and blasting DOD for not willingly using the force and the power. You blast the CIA for blocking Predator. You urge policymakers to imagine a day after hundreds of Americans lay dead in a home or abroad after a terrorist attack and ask themselves what else they could have done. You write this on September the 4th, 7 days before September 11th.
That's right.
What else could have been done, Mr. Clark?
Well, all of the things that we recommended in the plan or strategy, there's a lot of debate about whether it's a plan or a strategy or a series of options, but all of the things we recommended back in January were those things on the table in September. They were done. They were done after September 11th. They were all done. I didn't really understand why they couldn't have been done in February.
Well, let's say, Mr. Clark, I think this is a fair question. Let's say that you asked to brief the President of the United States on counterterrorism.
Mm-hmm.
Did you ask that?
I asked for a series of briefings on the issues in my portfolio, including counterterrorism and cybersecurity.
Did you get that request?
I did. I was given a briefing opportunity to brief on cybersecurity in June. I was told I could brief the President on terrorism after this policy development process was complete and we had the principals meeting and a draft national security policy decision that had been approved by the Deputies Committee.
Former counterterrorism chief Richard Clark testifying before the 9/11 commission. Just before his testimony in the morning, the commission staff released a report. Clearly, Richard Clark was not alone in the report. It said two veteran counterterrorism center officers, not clear whether Clark was one of them, were deeply involved in bin Laden issues, were so worried about an impending disaster that one of them told the commission they considered resigning and going public with their concerns. We're going to come back to Richard Clark's testimony in a minute.
Sitting here in limbo, sitting here in limbo, like a bird without a song.
This is Democracy Now!, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. 2 hours after the hearing, a fuming Condoleezza Rice, National Security Advisor, blasted Richard Clark's comments as, quote, scurrilous. Rice, who was Clark's boss, told reporters at the White House, quote, the story has so many twists and turns, he needs to get his story straight.
Over the 2 days of hearings, Clark's book was a central theme of discussion. Yesterday, Republican Commission member John Lehman questioned Clark about the allegations made in his book, Against All Enemies.
Dick, since you and I first served 28 years ago on the MBFR delegation, I have genuinely been a fan of yours. I've watched you labor without fear or favor in a succession of jobs where you really made a difference. And so when you agreed to spend as much time as you did with us in, as you say, 15 hours, I was very hopeful. And I attended one of those all-day sessions and read the other two transcripts, and I thought they were terrific. I thought here we have a guy who can be the Rosetta Stone for helping this commission do its job to help to have the American people grasp what the dysfunctional problems in this government are. And I thought you let the chips fall where they may. You made a few value judgments, which could be debated, but by and large, you were critical of the things, institutions, and people that could have done better, and some that did very badly. Certainly, the greater weight of this criticism fell during the Clinton years, simply because there were eight of them and only 7.5 months of the Bush years. I don't think you, in the transcripts that we have of your classified interviews, pulled punches in either direction. And frankly, a lot of my questioning this past 2 days has been drawn from some of the things that you articulated so well during the Clinton years, particularly because they stretched from the first, as you pointed out, attempt by Saddam to assassinate President Bush 41 right up through the end of the administration. But now we have the book. And I've published books, and I must say I am green with envy at the promotion department of your publisher. I never got Jim Thompson to stand before 50 photographers reading your book. And I certainly never got 60 Minutes to coordinate the showing of its interview with you with 15 network news broadcasts, the selling of the movie rights, and your appearance here today. So I would say bravo. Until I started reading those press reports. And I said, this can't be the same Dick Clark that testified before us, because all of the promotional material and all of the spin in the networks was that this is a rounding, devastating attack, this book, on President Bush. That's not what I heard in the interviews. And I hope you're going to tell me, as you apologize to the families for all of us who were involved in national security, that this tremendous difference, and not just in nuance, but in what it is you choose to, the stories you choose to tell, is really the result of your editors and your promoters rather than your studied judgment, because it is so different from the whole thrust of your testimony to us. And similarly, when you add to it the inconsistency between what your promoters are putting out and what you yourself said as late as August 05, you've got a real credibility problem. And because of my real genuine long-term admiration for you, I hope you'll resolve that credibility problem, because I'd hate to see you become totally shoved to one side during a presidential campaign as an active partisan selling a book.
Thank you, John. Let me talk about partisanship here, since you raise it. I've been accused of being a member of John Kerry's campaign team several times this week, including by the White House. So let's just lay that one to bed. I'm not working for the Kerry campaign. Last time I had to declare my party loyalty, it was to vote in the Virginia primary for President of the United States in the year 2000, and I asked for a Republican ballot. I worked for Ronald Reagan with you. I worked for the first President Bush, and he nominated me to the Senate as an assistant secretary of state, and I worked in his White House, and I've worked for this President Bush, and I'm not working for Senator Kerry. Now, the fact of the matter is I do co-teach a class with someone who works for Senator Kerry. That person is named Randy Beers. Randy Beers and I have worked together in the federal government, in the White House, in the State Department for 25 years. Randy Beers worked in the White House for Ronald Reagan. Randy Beers worked in the White House for the first President Bush, and Randy Beers worked in the White House for the second President Bush. And just because he is now working for Senator Kerry, I am not going to disassociate myself from one of my best friends and someone who I greatly respect and have worked with for 25 years. And yes, I will admit I co-teach a class at the Harvard University and the Georgetown University with Mr. Beers. That, I don't think, makes me a member of the Kerry campaign. The White House has said that my book is an audition for a high-level position in the Kerry campaign. So let me say here, as I am under oath, that I will not accept any position in the Kerry administration, should there be one, on the record, under oath. Now, as to your accusation that there is a difference between what I said to this commission in 15 hours of testimony and what I am saying in my book and what media outlets are asking me to comment on, I think there's a very good reason for that. In the 15 hours of testimony, no one asked me what I thought about the president's invasion of Iraq. And the reason I am strident in my criticism of the president of the United States is because by invading Iraq, something I was not asked about by the commission, but something I chose to write about a lot in the book, by invading Iraq, the president of the United States has greatly undermined the war on terrorism.
Richard Clark, testifying yesterday before the 911 Commission, the former counterterrorism chief under President Bush, responding to accusations of partisanship by Republican Commission member John Lehman. In September last year, Clark revealed that top White House officials approved the evacuation of some 140 influential Saudis, including relatives of Osama bin Laden, days after the September 11th attacks, at a time when all commercial private flights were grounded.
We covered this story in detail last week when we spoke with Craig Unger, who broke the story into Vanity Fair in September and is author of the new book, House of Bush, House of Saud. Commission member Tim Romer yesterday asked Clark about the controversial flights. His testimony represents the most extensive comments made by a public official on the subject to date.
There's a great deal of unanimity that the Saudis were not doing everything they could before 9/11 to help us in a host of different areas, that 15 of the 19 hijackers came from there, that we had trouble tracking some of the financing for terrorist operations, that we still have too many of the madrasas and the teachings of hatred of Christians and Jews and others coming out of some of these madrasas. We need to broaden and deepen this relationship. I will ask you a part A and a part B. Part A is, where do we go in this difficult relationship? And part B is to further look at the difficulty here. You made a decision after 9/11 to, I think, and I'd like to ask you more about this, to allow a plane of Saudis to fly out of the country. And when most other planes were grounded, this plane flew from the United States back to Saudi Arabia. I'd like to know why you made that decision, who was on this plane, and if the FBI ever had the opportunity to interview those people.
You're absolutely right that the Saudi Arabian government did not cooperate with us significantly in the fight against terrorism prior to 9/11. Indeed, it didn't really cooperate until after bombs blew up in Riyadh. Now, as to this controversy about the Saudi evacuation aircraft, let me tell you everything I know, which is that some in the days following 9/11, whether it was on 9/12 or 9/15, I can't tell you, we were in a constant crisis management meeting that had started the morning of 9/11 and ran for days on end. We were making lots of decisions, but we were coordinating them with all the agencies through the video teleconference procedure. Someone, and I wish I could tell you who, but I don't know who, someone brought to that group a proposal that we authorize a request from the Saudi embassy. The Saudi embassy had apparently said that they feared for the lives of Saudi citizens because they thought there would be retribution against Saudis in the United States as it became obvious to Americans that this attack was essentially done by Saudis. And that there were even Saudi citizens in the United States who were part of the bin Laden family, which is a very large family, very large family. The Saudi embassy therefore asked for these people to be evacuated. The same sort of thing that we do all the time in similar crises, evacuating Americans. The request came to me and I refused to approve it. I suggested that it be routed to the FBI, and that the FBI look at the names of the individuals who are going to be on the passenger manifest and that they approve it or not. I spoke with the, at that time, the number two person in the FBI, Dale Watson, and asked him to deal with this issue. The FBI then approved, after some period of time, and I can't tell you how long, approved the flight. Now, what degree of review the FBI did of those names, I cannot tell you. How many people there are on the plane, I cannot tell you. But I have asked since, were there any individuals on that flight that in retrospect the FBI wishes they could have interviewed in this country? And the answer I've been given is no. That there was no one who left that on that flight who the FBI now wants to interview.
Despite the fact that we don't know if Dale Watson interviewed them in the first place.
I don't think they were ever interviewed in this country.
Do we so they were not interviewed here. We have all their names. We don't know if there has been any follow-up to interview those people that were here and flown out of the country.
The last time I asked that question, I was informed that the FBI had still had no desire to interview any of these people.
Would you have a desire to interview some of these people that asked?
I don't know who they are.
We don't know who they are.
I don't know who they are. The FBI knew who they were because they had...
Given your confidence and your statements on the FBI, what's your level of comfort with this?
Well, I will tell you in particular about the ones that get the most attention here in the press, and they are members of the bin Laden family. I was aware for some time that there were members of the bin Laden family living in the United States. And let's see, in open session, I can say that I was very well aware of the members of the bin Laden family and what they were doing in the United States. And the FBI was extraordinarily well aware of what they were doing in the United States. And I was informed by the FBI that none of the members of the bin Laden family, this large clan, were doing anything in this country that was illegal or that raised their suspicions. And I believe the FBI had very good information and good sources of information about what the members of the bin Laden family were doing.
I've been very impressed with your memory sitting through all these interviews that the 9/11 Commission has conducted with you. I press you again to try to recall how this request originated. Who might have passed this on to you at the White House Situation Room, or who might have originated that request for the United States government to fly out? How many people on this plane?
I don't know.
We don't know how many people were on a plane that flew out of this country. Who gave the final approval then to say, yes, you're clear to go, it's all right with the United States government to go to Saudi Arabia?
I believe after the FBI came back and said it was all right with them, we ran it through the decision process for all of these decisions that we were making in those hours, which was the Interagency Crisis Management Group on the video conference. I was making or coordinating a lot of decisions on 9/11 and in the days immediately after. And I would love to be able to tell you who did it, who brought this proposal to me, but I don't know. Since you pressed me, the two possibilities that are most likely are either the Department of State or the White House Chief of Staff's office. But I don't know.
Former counterterrorism chief Richard Clark testifying at the 9/11 Commission hearing yesterday. This is Democracy Now! Back in a minute.
From the Indians, welcome the pilgrims, and to the buffaloes who once ruled the plain. Like the vultures circling beneath the dark clouds, looking for the rain, looking for the rain. Just like the cities that stagger on the coastline, and a nation that just can't stand much more. Like the forest buried beneath the highway, never had a chance to grow.
This is Democracy Now!, and that's Gil Scott-Heron, Winter in America. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. In a few minutes, we're going to St. Kitts to Randall Robinson for the latest Democracy Now! Exclusive on the situation of the Aristides in the Caribbean and the role Condoleezza Rice is playing in trying to have them once again ousted. But the last clip first of Richard Clark.
Yes, Richard Clark, the former counterterrorism chief, was being questioned at yesterday's 911 hearing by Commissioner Tim Romer. Another source of controversy during Clark's testimony was a background briefing he gave in early August 2002 to a handful of reporters. Early yesterday, Fox News published a transcript of the briefing on its website after getting clearance from the White House. In it, Clark describes the handover of intelligence from the Clinton administration to the Bush administration. Clark came under fire from Commission member James Thompson, a former Republican governor of Illinois, who alleged that none of the book's attacks on Bush can be found in Clark's 2002 briefing.
In August of 2002, you intended to mislead the press, did you not?
No. I think there's a very fine line that anyone who's been in the White House in any administration can tell you about. And that is, when you are special assistant to the president and you're asked to explain something that is potentially embarrassing to the administration because the administration didn't do enough or didn't do it in a timely manner and is taking political heat for it, as was the case there, you have a choice. Actually, I think you have three choices. You can resign rather than do it. I chose not to do that. Second choice is...
Why was that, Mr. Clark? Finally resigned because you were frustrated?
I was, at that time, at the request of the president, preparing a national strategy to defend America's cyberspace. Something which I thought then and think now is vitally important. I thought that completing that strategy was a lot more important than whether or not I had to provide emphasis in one place or other while discussing the facts of this particular news story. The second choice one has, Governor, is whether or not to say things that are untruthful. And no one in the Bush White House asked me to say things that were untruthful, and I would not have said them in any event. The third choice that one has is to put the best face you can for the administration on the facts as they were, and that is what I did. And I think that is what most people in the White House, in any administration, do when they're asked to explain something that is embarrassing to the administration.
But you will admit that
what you said in August of 2002 is inconsistent with what you say in your book.
No, I don't think it's inconsistent at all. I think, as I said in your last round of questioning, Governor, that it's really a matter here of emphasis and tone. And that it's really, I mean, what you're suggesting perhaps is that as Special Assistant to the President of the United States, when asked to give a press backgrounder, I should spend my time in that press backgrounder criticizing him. I think that's somewhat of an unrealistic thing to expect.
Well, what it suggests to me is that there is one standard of candor and morality for White House special assistants and another standard of candor and morality for the rest of America. I don't get that.
I don't think it's a question of morality at all. I think it's a question of politics.
Well, I...
Counterterrorism Chief Richard Clark testifying before the 9/11 Commission yesterday. This is Democracy Now!
One person not testifying was National Security Advisor Condoleezza Rice, who has refused to appear before the commission to give sworn testimony. Security Advisor Rice has been very busy on a different front. Haiti, the crisis in Haiti. Rice and other officials have very publicly expressed their anger at President Jean-Bertrand Aristide's return to the Western Hemisphere on March 15th after he spent 2 weeks in the Central African Republic. Aristide is currently in Jamaica with his wife Mildred and their two young daughters. The Bush administration has characterized his return to the Caribbean as inflaming the situation in Haiti and has gone as far as to label his presence an incitement to violence. Aristide maintains that he was kidnapped as part of a U.S. orchestrated coup.
Democracy Now! Listeners and viewers know that it was a small delegation of people led by U.S. Congressmember Maxine Waters, a member of the Jamaican Parliament, Sharon Hay Webster, and TransAfrica founder Randall Robinson, along with Aristide's lawyer Ira Kurzban, who chartered a plane to go to the Central African Republic to pick up the Aristides and escort them back to the Caribbean. You can go to our website, democracynow.org, to see the chronicle of that trip. Well, just as the Aristides are settling in Jamaica over this two-week period, news broke that the 15-nation Caribbean community known as CARICOM had sent a formal request to the government of Nigeria asking them to host Aristide. Jamaica, CARICOM, and the Nigerian government have all indicated pressure is being put on them by Washington. Randall Robinson joins us now from St. Kitts. Can you tell us exactly what is happening?
Hello, I hope you can hear me better than I'm hearing you. I think I heard enough to make out your question. I have learned from a White House source that Condoleezza Rice has pointedly threatened the Jamaican government, telling it to expel President Aristide or face the consequences. The administration wants President Aristide out of the region, as this is a clear measure of how much broad support the president still enjoys as the democratically elected leader of Haiti inside the country, because the U.S. Apparently views his mere presence in Jamaica as a threat to their control, along with the thugs and the installed government in Haiti. Jamaica has not buckled. They did have discussions with the Nigerians, who were pressured to grant this temporary asylum to President Aristide. President Aristide does not want to go to Nigeria and has made that plain enough, and that is off. He remains and will for the indefinite future in Jamaica, in spite of these clear threats from Condoleezza Rice made to the government of Jamaica.
Randall Robinson, what kind of pressure are you aware of? What specific pressure the U.S. government is bringing on Jamaica?
Well, I don't know that the specific actions that the U.S. would take were spelled out. It was clear that Ms. Rice told the Jamaican government that if Aristide was not expelled immediately, and anything happened to any American forces in Haiti, that the consequences of that would be exacted against President or against Jamaica by the United States with full force. Now, what one doesn't know what that means, but we know what America is capable of doing. It abducted the president. It executed the coup. It took him to a country with which it has no relations, nor does any African country to speak of, that the State Department warns all people not to go to. We brought him back to Jamaica, to his home region, and the U.S., of course, has brought the full weight of its authority upon Jamaica to have him expelled immediately, fearing that his simple presence there would cause people in Haiti to rally to salvage their democracy.
The Associated Press reported yesterday that summary executions of Aristide followers have continued to occur. There were four supposedly by Haitian police in Port-au-Prince, and an AP reporter was also reported that in Cape Haitian, he witnessed Louis Jodel Chamblain, the former FRAP leader, actually putting people on trial and rendering verdicts, even though there were French troops in Cape Haitian.
The French and American troops are standing by while the summary executions are carried out. The mayor, Jean-Charles Moisy of Cap Haitian, or the town of Milo, which is very near Cap Haitian, is in hiding now, and he has said that at least 50 people are killed by the thugs in Cap Haitian a day now. All of this done with the sufferance of the French and American troops.
How do you know, Randall Robinson, that Condoleezza Rice is the one who's applying pressure to Jamaica to expel the Aristides?
My source in the White House named Condoleezza Rice.
And what has been the response of Jamaica? How is it that Aristide is not gone?
Well, as I said, Jamaica has not buckled, and Jamaica has made it clear that they have no plans to expel President Aristide. Jamaica deserves an enormous amount of credit. Prime Minister Patterson has been principled and brave. He recognizes, of course, that President Aristide was twice elected democratically. That there were no questions about the elections. The last one he won with 94% of the vote. We all know that the country has been taken over by thugs armed by the United States. This is a coup executed by America, a coup against democracy in Haiti. The CARICOM nations, of course, will stand shoulder to shoulder with Jamaica.
Randall Robinson, we want to thank you for being with us. Congressmember Maxine Waters will be holding a news conference today at 11, and we will bring folks the results of that news conference and what she says. That does it for the show. Our website, democracynow.org. Democracy Now! Produced by Mike Berkshire, Fabio Caduce, Anna Nagar, Elizabeth Press, John Hamilton, Jeremy Scahill. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. Thanks for joining us.